Is the alternative media exposing government corruption, defending our suspended constitution, demanding the rights of we the people, broadcasting the truth.
Hey gang, today I'm bringing you an interview with the British nationalist Jez Turner that we recorded on the morning of April 8th. I held back on airing this last week as I felt the urgent need to address the missile strike against the Syrian Air Force base. What has transpired over the past week makes it clear that the administration of Donald Trump has succumbed to some sort of Jewish coup d'etat. I call it a Jew d'etat. It is hard to say what role Trump himself had in this Jew d'etat. It has been my feeling that in the face of an onslaught from the Jewish media and the nascent impeachment proceedings in Zionist-occupied Congress, he attacked Syria in order to buy himself some breathing space. Other people suggest some sort of blackmail may have been in the works. Still, others think he is an opportunist and lacking in principle, or even that this was the plan all along. It will take a while for the smoke to clear. But no matter what the case, we need to call out the Jewish nature of this coup d'etat and destroy the Jewish privilege of being above any criticism once and for all. Remember, the basis of Jewish power is the ability to stifle any discussion of Jewish power. As for today's podcast, it is extremely relevant to the issue of Jewish privilege and the lack of freedom to call it out that keeps us under the yoke of Jewish tyranny. And now, please enjoy the show. Hey gang, welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. This week, my guest is Jez Turner, Jeremy Turner, but you go by Jez, correct?
Short for Jeremy, yes. Yes, Jez. One syllable, sounds more masculine. Yeah, people just, it's easier for them to call me Jez than Jeremy, you know?
That's right. And believe it or not, Jeremy, Jez, is from the UK.
And London, yes. Greetings from London. Today in England we have the Grand National Horse Race, and I've got £5 on a horse called Cocktails at Dawn, and it's on 80-1. So I'm hoping for the sake of the London Forum that I'll win today.
That would be nice. That would be nice. So you're there from the Caliphate of London.
And yes, very sunny today, very sunny.
Very sunny. Well, are the Muslims bringing their climate with them?
They certainly bring their noise. Whenever it's a nice weekend in London, I've moved to much of a slum in North London now. And one thing that you know about where you live is the music, the noise, the racket. And for some reason, the ethnics just play music very loud with the windows wide open all day long. So you can't really relax with all that boom, boom, boom music. But climate change, who knows? But it's certainly overcrowded in London and Britain.
Wow.
And the world's getting overcrowded, so perhaps that's causing some effect. Yeah, I don't know.
It is, and the big groups that are reproducing, Africans in particular, but also many Muslim countries, have a high birth rate. I was in Southeast Asia, Malaysia and Indonesia not too long ago, and I remember walking around Indonesia, and everywhere I went, I heard the prayers or the calls to prayer from the towers of the mosques.
It's actually recording. It's from the mosques, from the towers. The imam should climb the tower 5 times a day and read out the call to prayer. That's what he should do. But it's all loudspeakers now and recordings, and they're very loud. If you go to East London, Whitechapel, there's a very big mosque there. And if ever I have to give an interview to some sort of journalist, I say, well, I'll meet you there. You know, at a certain time, and we go there, sit outside a cafe in which was a white working class area. And when this call to prayer goes out, hundreds of very, shall we say, Asian dressed, foreign looking people swarm onto the streets heading for this mosque, which looks the thing. It's got a proper tower and it looks like a proper Eastern mosque. And there's a call to prayer going on, and there's hundreds of these dark, dusky gentlemen trooping past. And the journalist's eyes go, oh my gosh, you know, Demos is this bad. Exactly. Most journalists, mainstream journalists, do not live in the real world. So it's quite good to take them down there and talk to them. But on the whole, I don't bother with mainstream journalists now. They're just part of the regime, part of the deep state, part of the Jewish deep state. But it's quite interesting to see the reaction of normal people when they see all that.
It is. And I've never spent that much time in London or in England. I've been there a few times. But like so many Americans, I'm at least part English. I have that ancestry, and I feel a kind of connection. And growing up, I was exposed to a lot of British culture, a lot of books, children's books, or TV shows. You know, I think of Alice in Wonderland or Winnie the Pooh. They took place in Britain, and there was a British feel to them. TV shows like The Saint with Roger Moore. Do you remember The Saint?
I do. Very good TV show. And there's a scene in that where the heroine misbehaves, and he takes her over his knee and gives her a spank.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I remember that one. They had gone for a long walk, and he was getting her ready for marriage with his best friend, and they had gone for a long walk, and she had misbehaved.
And that's what she needed. She needed a good telling off, a good seeing to.
He needed
and
to,
she was better for it. She was better for it.
Yes, she appreciated it at the end. She hated him along the way, and then she appreciated it at the end and went on to be a good wife. I think Upstairs, Downstairs, or a lot of the BBC sitcoms, well, even Monty Python, but at Are You Being Served, which took place in the 1970s. And not that they were a scientific survey of the demography of London, but they were intended to be a reflection of British society. And you'd see scenes of London. In the Roger Moore show, in The Saint, I remember one episode that focused on boxing, and there was a Jamaican boxer. And occasionally you'd see foreigners, but they might be exiled European royalty, something like that. Britain was British. Your diversity would be the Scottish butler or an Irish chambermaid. And Britain was British. And even in the 1970s, these sitcoms from the 70s it was. But things have changed so rapidly. Because you think of the 1960s, that wasn't long ago. I went to London in the 1980s, and I remember going to, I can't remember, was it Houston or Houston? I want to say Houston, but something like Houston.
Hoxton?
Hoxton?
Why would anyone go there? Why would you go to Hoxton?
Because
don't go there. Anyone listening in America, do not go to Hoxton.
I think I went.
In fact, stay clear of East London. And Southall, which is West London.
Well, this was.
And Peckham and Brixton and Tottenham. In fact, just stay in the centre, okay? And Kensington.
Well, this was 1980s, and I think I was going there because somebody had recommended a squatter house. I could just go squat in a house for a few days until I got over my jet lag, and then I could get on with my exploration of the British Isles.
It would be a flop house now. It'd be a drug heroin den.
Wow.
Wouldn't be there now. Squatters have moved out. They moved to the nicer areas. Either they stay in Central or Kensington, where it's still pretty white and there's law and order, or they've moved to Romford. There's an anarchist, famous anarchist, who was involved in designing Bitcoin, and now he designs dark wallet. He's half Scottish, half Kurdish, and he's just gone abroad to fight for some Kurdish anarchist group against the evil Assad regime or against ISIS, whatever. And he's returned and had his passport stolen. And there was an article in the Evening Standard all about him, Ahmed Taka. And he lives in a squat in Romford. Now, Romford is Essex. It's not London. It's way out. You know, it's where whites have fled to avoid central London. It's not Hoxton. You know, and he had this interview with the Evening Standard. And it showed, he went into his study, his den, where he had all his anarchist flags. You know, he's praising the city of Rojava, which is like a anarchist paradise. You know, Abdullah Öcalan, who was the head of the communist Kurdish group, PKK, wrote this book, Democracy for a New Civilization. He was praising all this and talking about how wonderful anarchism was and how dastardly it was for the British government to take his passport off, you know, after coming back from fighting in the Middle East like this, you know. And he's a wealthy individual. His family are wealthy. They're from Broadstairs, you know, at least the British part of it is. And he's living in this squat, but he's got lots of money on his hands. And he went to a Jeremy Corbyn meeting recently, you know, because he's a sort of hippie left-winger type sort of person. And one point he made very interesting, he said, all the people in this Labour Party meeting were talking about, we must look after the working class, help the working class. And he said, why? The working class no longer vote Labour. And of course they don't, because Hoxton now, I don't know what it was like when you were there, but the whites have all fled, white flight. I mean, were there any whites there when you went to that squat in Hoxton?
Well, there were, because this is over 30 years ago, but I went there to recover from jet lag, and I wasn't there very long, it was just a few days, but I remember wandering around in the middle of the night, because that's when I was awake, and
you were lucky to be alive.
It was very sketchy. I remember.
Not sport. Don't do this at home, children. Don't wander around in London at night.
Yeah, I remember seeing men with enormous accumulations of dreadlock, for instance, something that. Yes. I guess dreadlocks have become more in vogue in the continental United States, but it was something that was kind of strange at the time. And that was my first introduction to diversity, old world style. Later on, got other introductions to it. I went to Wolverhampton.
Oh, my gosh. Wolverhampton. Oh, dear. Well, so you got the Asian side of it then.
Well, right. The Slattery's had come through Wolverhampton on their trek from Ireland to the New World. And I wanted to go by and see what it was like. And I walked by a school and looked at the kids playing in the school. And most of them were Sikhs.
Yes. This is a point they don't mention. I had a friend who used to live in North West London until quite recently, Wembley sort of area. And it wasn't until they tried to put their child into a school, they suddenly realized that, when he was a child, the father, it was pretty bad. You know, there was lots of different ethnic groups there, but there was some whites and there was a variety of ethnic groups. But now he put his child into school and it was just Pakistanis. Boom, that was it. And no whites, just no other ethnic groups. His excuse was he wanted some diversity, so he took his children north into Hertfordshire and lived there, you know. But what people don't realize is, although you've got diversity, you've got immigrant ethnic ghettos, you've got Sikhs in some areas, you've got Hindus in Southall, you've got Bangladeshis in Brick Lane, Whitechapel area, you know, in South London, you've got African groups, you've got Nigerians fighting with Jamaicans, you've got Africans of all sorts, Zambians fighting with Kurds. Recently, a Kurdish asylum seeker from Iran. Let's bear in mind, there's no war in Iran. There's no reason to seek asylum from Iran. A Kurdish Iranian was attacked. Three of them were attacked by some Zambians who have their own pub across the road, you know, and it made headlines in the papers that this, you know, asylum seeker was attacked by racist, evil white racists. And then the truth began to seep out. The Evening Standard did a rush job on the front page. Find these evil racists, you know. And it was three black men. It was 30 of them in total. And they kicked this lad so badly, he got a blood clot on his brain and what have you, and was unrecognizable in hospital. And then the press realized, oops, these people aren't whites that we thought they were. You know, the local MP called them scum when he thought they were whites. Now he's having to apologize because they weren't whites, they were blacks. And he's called black people scum. But it is a complete and utter mess. If the powers that be have sold this to white liberals, saying diversity means safety, means a wonderful rainbow nation, they should go to Germany and see where the Kurds fight the Turks on the streets and have the German police run away when this happens, because it's just very violent. So you went to Wolverhampton, you saw Sikhs.
Yeah, I did.
So that's interesting, yeah.
Well, right, and the diversity, it is meant to create a kind of safety, but it's not a safety for Britons, or it's not a safety for Americans. They write about it themselves. Leading Jewish intellectuals will write about trying to create a multicultural society where the white majorities will no longer be a majority, no longer able to form a nationalist party that would threaten Jewish interests or, in their own paranoid mind, Jewish safety.
And they sell it to the whites by saying, then you will be safe. I mean, this is what happened in Sweden yesterday. There was a terrorist attack. Islamist with a lorry rammed down pedestrians and smashed his lorry through the glass window of a department store to kill some shoppers. And a local Swedish man was asked, you know, are you shocked by this? He says, yes, I was shocked by this. I thought Sweden was safe. I thought it was, I mean, it's so diverse here. It's so diverse. What was he saying? He was actually saying subconsciously that an all-white society was not safe. Mm-hmm. A homogeneous society was not safe. He's been sold a lie that diversity equals safety. That if you have an all-white society, then the non-whites will come and attack you indiscriminately just to kill you. He's been sold that subconsciously. And he thinks by creating a society where whites aren't a majority, where they can mix in with all these other people, that no horrible non-whites will come and kill them. The reality is far, far from the truth, because these non-whites don't think like white people. They just want to hit the West. They just want to kill anybody. They will kill people in their own country, their own ethnic group, with no qualm whatsoever. So why on earth wouldn't they kill them here as well? You know, it's a complete myth that the Jews have sold us this diversity equals safety. It is not. I mean, more people die from black muggings and stabbings and rapings than they do from Islamists. But Islamist attacks are just more high profile and at the moment make the news. There will come a day when, just like the attacks by black and other ethnic groups that kill individual whites for so-called petty reasons, though subconsciously there's probably an anti-white racism going on there.
Is.
They no longer make the news. They no longer make the news. And soon, these attacks by terrorists will no longer make the news, because these attacks on whites, whatever they are, whether they're by truck bombs or by trucks, whether by knives or machetes or by shootings or by punchings and general attacks, they do not fit the Zionist, the Jewish, the globalist agenda. because these attacks wake people up. It's a cold dose of harsh reality, and reality is on our side. And when people get reality, when they see through the fog of the mass media, it frightens them. I was living in South London a few years ago, and at 6 a.m, a businessman was mugged on the way to work. He had his briefcase stolen, his wallet stolen, his phone stolen. He was mugged and stabbed, but he survived. He was okay. And the people who lived 100 yards away from this did not know anything about it. Yet, it even got into the local paper, but they don't read the local paper because most people now are ruthless, cosmopolitan. They move around. The traditional rooted communities in London have fled. There's very few of them left now. They read the paper, local paper. They know what's going on. And they live in fear, and they're trying to get out. But the people who come in, the students, the tourists, the people who are here, just yuppie types, whatever, you know, or slumming it, you know, middle-class people slumming it, pretending to be poor, they have no connection with reality, with local reality. They don't see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that lack of connection with reality is why this notion that diversity equals our strength can remain in currency among enough people that they've been able to, not in the last election, but at least form a coalition with Jewish interests and with non-white voters. And it was expected that this coalition was going to permanently rule America. Donald Trump somehow managed to win that election last year by the skin of his teeth. But when he had announced his proposed ban on Muslim immigration until our officials figure out what the hell is going on, that was direct quote from his proposal.
We know what's going on. We know.
But the response from Hillary was exactly the type of thing you had said, that no, we need the Muslims to make us safe, that this proposed ban on Muslim immigration is dangerous because it's going to offend the very people we need to help keep us safe. And not just people overseas. We need these people in the United States to help us in our struggle against radical Islam. So we need more Muslims in the United States to help us in our struggle against radical Islam. I don't even think she said radical Islam, but whatever term she used. And if there's any logic to it, it's a very twisted logic. It wasn't persuasive enough, and she lost the election, although she did get a pretty considerable plurality of the popular vote. There were a couple of minor candidates who were able to win a much higher percentage of the vote than usual. But Donald Trump won by the skin of his teeth, and we'll see what happens with President Trump.
Well, that travel ban, a lot of people are easily fooled by what the ruling ideologies tell them, what the, shall we say, the Jewish mass media tells them. You see it in London when there's a demonstration against the far right. A few Muslims will turn up, a few blacks will turn up, but most of them, they're not really into this liberalism, this Jewish agenda. And the travel ban, you see, when they think about it, it doesn't really affect the average Muslim in these countries, because the average Muslim in these countries cannot afford to buy an air ticket to come to America. The only people who can afford to buy these air tickets are the global cosmopolitans. And these exist in all countries, whether they are corrupt government officials in an Islamic country or bankers or merchants or whatever. These are the citizens of nowhere. The citizens of anywhere, they can live anywhere, it doesn't matter where they live, they just move on, they don't care, they have no roots, all they care about is money. And these are the people who, you could put it brutally, bluntly, these are the people who make very good servants for the Jews. And these people do travel the world, they do live in various countries, they've probably got houses in different places, and it did affect them. But the average person, the average traditional person in these Islamic countries does not want to go to the United States of America. He sees all the pornography and all the decadence and degeneration. He doesn't want to go and lose his culture. He doesn't want to go and lose his roots. It's only the scum of the earth who want to come here. It's only the terrorists and the criminal types and those who've got the money to come here in the first place. Yes, they would like a better life, but banning an airfare, you know, stopping them flying by plane to America, it's like saying to you, you can't buy any more diamond tiaras, Patrick. Mm-hmm. Well, you couldn't afford a diamond tiara. Why would you buy one anymore? You know, it's a complete myth. And yet, the powers that be, the powers that shouldn't be, and the Jewish deep state has managed to get these Muslims all angry about it and demonstrating about it. But it's nonsense, really, when you think about it as a sensible man. They just, you know, they couldn't afford the airfare in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we've been just chatting about London and about Muslims, and I didn't really give you a proper introduction. So you are one of the leading British nationalists. Now, you're not part of UKIP, are you?
No, no, UKIP is a bit more moderate. Sort of a ramp, a stepping stone to the real thing.
To the real
thing. Hardcore, to the real truth.
And you've come to an increased prominence lately. A month ago, you had an interview that was on primetime British television.
Right, what it was, we have to go back a bit here, a few years. What was on primetime television and radio at the beginning of March was a speech I gave in Whitehall, opposite Downing Street, on a Saturday. And this demonstration was the second demonstration against the Shomrim. Now, I'm sure your viewers realize what the Shomrim is, but if anyone's new to the show, I'll just explain it. It is basically a vigilante force for Jews, run by Jews, composed of Jews. And they patrol Jewish areas, and they wear uniforms. And these uniforms look very much like British police uniforms. They drive cars, and these cars look exactly like British police cars, except the word police is replaced by Shomrim. They are funded by the government. They get weapons training from the British police force. They sometimes enforce rules that men must walk on this side of the street, women must walk on that side of the street. They are known or suspected of overlooking crimes committed by Jews and focusing on any behavior crimes or potential crimes committed by non-Jews. They have been accused of harassing non-Jews. So this is allowed. Now, no other ethnic group in London or elsewhere in Britain is allowed a vigilante force. The Muslims in the East End of London tried, and they were quickly raided and arrested and suppressed.
And you called this the Shomrim? Shomrim?
Shomrim. Shomrim. Right, look that up, Shomrim. It means guardians, really. And in East London, the Muslims went around confiscating alcohol, you know, telling people not to sell alcohol, and the police shut them down. The whites tried once in the 80s in Birmingham, and they were pretty much shut down. During the Black Riots a few years ago, various ethnic groups put up quick ad hoc sort of gangs of people to defend their areas. The Sikhs did it, and they were ignored. The Hindus did it, and they were ignored. Ditto the Muslims. But the whites did it in southeast London. The police came along and hemmed them in, cattled them, and stopped them defending their areas. However, the Jews are allowed to have this vigilante force with government backing, with uniforms, with cars, with training. And several police officers in North London, because this is where the area is, it's Stamford Hill, it's Golders Green, it's these areas. By the way, these areas have always been known as areas of spiv crime. You can understand why.
Spiv
crime is... Spiv was a term for someone who, how shall we say, avoided national service, avoided serving in the military during the wars, mm-hmm. and sold black market goods. Mm-hmm. There's a famous novel about the 1930s period about a hero that fights underworld criminals. And this underworld criminal is based in Golders Green. And anyway, several police officers were very unhappy with this situation and resigned over this. They said, well, this is ridiculous. You can't have two police forces. And they resigned over it. And the Shomrim was basically hushed up, except for an article in an independent newspaper and a bit of online stuff. And nobody really knew what it was. So I think it was March 2015. A small rally and march was held by some nationalists in Stamford Hill. And a very famous guy called Martin Webster gave a speech. He used to be the national activities organizer for the National Front in the 70s. So he's well known among nationalist circles. And there was about 20 people came to this march. And it achieved quite a bit of coverage, but not as much as it perhaps would have done if it wasn't focusing on the Shomrim. I mean, there are two markers for whether a rally or a demonstration is successful. The first is it achieves massive publicity. It means mm-hmm. it's successful. Mm-hmm. The second way you know it's successful is that it achieves zero publicity. Mm-hmm. It has a blanket ban on it. The Jews do not want it covered, do not want it highlighted. And that's a very firm indicator that you're on target. Either you get the flak or it goes silent, that shows you're on target. So that was the first demonstration. And because of that demonstration, there was a young man called Joshua Bonehill who did a lot of online work. I suppose you'd call it trolling with cartoons and this sort of thing. And his major troll was stop the Jewification of North London. And he got arrested for that and put under house arrest, basically. So he's way down in the southwest of England. He couldn't come to London anyway. So a second demonstration was planned. And this is the one I agreed to speak at. I wasn't on the first one. And this demonstration was planned for Golders Green, which is regarded as the center of the, how should we call it, the Jewish Republic of North London. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they could put up with one demonstration, and then they thought, what we'll do is we will ignore the Shomrim aspect of it. You know, this is the mass media talking, this is the powers that be talking, but we'll pretend it's against the anti-Jewification of North London. We'll go with the Joshua Bonehill meme, and we'll highlight that and just ignore the fact that it's about the Shomrim. But it was about the Shomrim. So the left and the Jews and the Zionists mobilized, and the police felt they couldn't guarantee a riot wouldn't erupt. So the rally was moved, with the organizers' consent, to Whitehall, opposite number 10 Downing Street.
And isn't that the seat of the British Foreign Ministry?
Everything's there in Whitehall, but number 10 is where the Prime Minister lives. Number 11 is the Chancellor, Downing Street, and all the government ministries are along in Whitehall. It connects basically Westminster, where Big Ben is, the Houses of Parliament, to Trafalgar Square. So it's the bang center in the center of London, where everything happens. So we were rather pleased with that. So come the day, we marched down there from our RV point, rendezvous point, and there's hundreds of screaming Zionists, and it's like a Lincoln Rockwell rally, if you can imagine. You know, they're screaming and yelling, and my God, they're ugly. And so we were there, 30 of us, all the world's press, because this thing had been building up over the weeks, and we were carrying our various flags. The opposition all surrounded us. There was a sort of pen. We were given this sort of pen, little barriers. This is your area here. This is the opposition's pen further up the road. But there was other groups of Jewish supremacists who stormed down and tried to sort of push themselves through the pen, but just two police lines protected them. And so we had an hour, so we began our speeches. Now, you've got all the world's press. You've got Russia Today. You've got various independent television stations. You've got all the Israeli television stations there. You've got the mainstream television stations. And I was told, right, Jez, it's your turn now. Your turn to give a speech. Now, bear in mind, I couldn't really hear what anyone was saying because they were screaming so much and spitting and yelling. So I thought, well, what do I speak about? Do I give a sort of moderate, perfectly safe speech? Or do I be a bit more daring?
So you didn't have a pre-prepared speech?
Not so much. I had a few notes knocking around, you know, in my hand. And I went for the sort of more daring one. And my speech was about free speech. But as subheadings, there was the extent of Jewish power in Britain and how this power is used to suppress free speech. And this was the whole tenor of my speech. A speech about free speech in front of a baying Zionist mob, yes. And it was filmed by various people. And, it went off pretty well, actually. You know, nobody could really hear it, but my speech began with a minute's silence, 1 minute silence, for the victims of Zionist terrorism in Palestine, in particular, the British victims. We're talking of the King David Hotel here, the two sergeants who were hung with razor wire in the olive groves and booby-trapped. It's about 100. Was it 1,000? There's quite a few casualties in Palestine, the Palestine campaign. I think about 1,000 people died in total. If you include civilians and
1,000 British people.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. We're talking about
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
It's time for you to have your own custom smartphone app for your business and pay way less than you can imagine. Introducing the I Can Get To Silent Salesman mobile marketing app, a global mobile marketing and communication tool for your business. Go to appsapart.com and learn how you could earn up to $36,351 or more per month just by inviting two people or less into a $14.95 per month program. Go to appsapart.com and be sure to watch the video at the top of the site and listen to the audio message from the CEO near the bottom. This is something you won't want to miss. Go to appsapart.com now or call 646-860-9540. That's 646-860-9540. Get the I Can Get To. That's ICANGET, the number 2, Silent Salesman App at appsapart.com. That's APPSAPART.com.
You've probably heard about all the great benefits of goat milk soap. But did you know? Some companies take shortcuts. At Old New England Soap, we make our organic goat's milk soap using 36% goat's milk. That's 17% more than most others. Our bars are larger, so they last longer, producing lots of lather packed with vitamins. And our soap is a natural moisturizer that smooths dry and damaged skin. Order online at oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. You've tried the rest. Now try the best. Oldnesoap.com.
Water-based soaps on supermarket shelves use harsh chemical acids to break down dead skin cells. And that's just not good for you. At Old New England Soap, our soaps are made without chemical ingredients, contain no alcohol or petroleum products, and use 85% organic materials and carry the USDA's organic certification. Try some today. Go to oldnesoap.com. That's oldnesoap.com. Oldnesoap.com.
Imagine a pill that can improve your focus, your memory, your sleep, a catalyst to improve your brain chemistry. Dr. Bill's Cognition Plus is truly the smarter in an hour pill. A combination of amino acids, trace minerals, and B vitamins, Cognition Plus is made with specialized herbal extracts that will enhance and support brain function. Our customers say,
I feel more focused.
My memory's getting better.
I can work longer with more useful hours.
Power up your neurotransmitters that have been depleted, like dopamine and norepinephrine. Stimulate the release of others, like serotonin and oxytocin. Improve circulation and energy production. Protect your mind and your loved ones today. Order Dr. Bill Deagle's Cognition Plus at 888-212-8871 or go online to NutriMedical.com. That's 888-212-8871 or NutriMedical.com.
This is Dr. Bill Deagle of the NutriMedical Report, 12 to 3, Monday to Friday. Call-ins are welcome to the show. You can order at 888-212-8871 or NutriMedical.com.
Hey there, quick question for you. Would you be okay with more energy, more endurance, thicker, healthier hair, a better mood, reduced appearance of wrinkles, improved sleep, improved blood pressure and cholesterol profiles? Improved vision? Improved memory? Okay then. Well now, have you heard of Nature's Youth RSF? It's from the anti-aging experts at naturesyouth.com. Naturesyouth.com. See, at Nature's Youth, they understand exactly what it means to provide top quality health products. And Nature's Youth customers not only improve their health, they know they're also providing their body with the right nourishment to maintain that peak performance and fight the aging process. If health, wellness, and nutrition are what you desire, choose Nature's Youth RSF. I did. You see, you're going to get older. It's just up to you how you feel when you get there. Get started today. Nature's Youth RSF. Simple to use, simple to order. Go to naturesyouth.com. That's naturesyouth.com. Naturesyouth.com.
So we had a minute of silence.
1947, 48, right?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people remember this. We had been told we were there, you know, in World War II, fighting to save the Jews. And how did they repay us? By killing us in Palestine. And they tried in Britain as well. A member of the SAS had his brother blown up with a parcel bomb. Very horrible death. And there were several attacks on the British Colonial Club and a few other places in central London, a few terrorist attacks. And a few that didn't actually take place that were thwarted. Jewish terrorism has always happened in London. This is the siege of Sydney Street, the Hoxton outrage. There's always been Jewish anarchists blowing things up in Britain ever since they arrived here from Eastern Europe and Russia. Anyway, so we had this minute's silence, and they weren't silent, obviously. So that gives you an idea of the speech. And I said various things in my speech, but I don't remember what they all were. But it basically said, why have the Jews got this vigilante group, the Shomrim, why they allowed it? And the theme was that they are allowed it because of the power they have. And I said, we're silenced from speaking out about this situation. They silence us by threats of ostracization, through losing our job, through losing our friends, family, status, you know, through putting us in prison. But I said, look, we've nothing left to lose anymore now. We have no jobs. There are no more jobs, no real jobs. You've destroyed our communities. Immigration has destroyed our communities. Feminism has destroyed the role of the male. And I went through the whole list of things that the liberal agenda, call it what you will, the Jewish agenda, has achieved in Britain, or which they're so proud of. They're always going about multiculturalism being wonderful, multiracialism being so wonderful. I said, look, we've nothing left to lose. You can call us racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, Nazi, fascist, blah, 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 but we don't care anymore. You know? And then I ended my speech, apparently, with free England from Jewish control.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bit that really triggered the powers that be.
And was this recorded?
Oh, lots of stations were recording it.
Okay.
You can go onto YouTube, and if you key in anti-Shomrim demonstration Whitehall, you'll eventually find it there.
Okay.
It's very hard to listen to. But even the Jewish groups who are trying to prosecute me, they have tried to do transcripts. And it's quite funny reading their transcripts. They've got a lot of things wrong. They don't quite understand what I'm talking about in some respects. Their history is awful. Yeah. So it was the end bit of the speech.
And
listen, soldiers, listen to me. It's time we liberate. You know, basically, all these wars we fight abroad, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, all these stupid things. I was saying, listen, soldiers, listen to me. Don't bother trying to liberate these countries across the sea. It's time we liberated our own country. And that's how I ended. And these sort of things, you know, free England from Jewish control. The Jewish groups reported me to the police saying I should be arrested, I should be executed, I should be tortured, I should be shut up, basically. And
because there's no First Amendment in Great Britain or most other countries.
Well, you know, we've governed Britain, England, English common law just applies common sense. You can say whatever you want as long as you don't say kill people, you know, as long as you don't preach violence. And then they've brought in all these race relations laws to sort of basically protect Jewish power and prevent people complaining about the Jewish agenda. And this began to bring in ideas where you try to get inside the person's mind to understand what he was saying and why he was saying it. And was he perhaps trying to encourage violence 17 steps removed from the actual go and kill these people sort of thing. So you got into some really crazy situations. Law should be there to provide certainty. And it must be believed by everybody. It must be accepted by everybody. It must be obvious and common sense. But it's no longer that. They created this big grey area where they can do what they want. And it especially used to scare people from discussing what's important. The Vincentian canon, quod semper, quod ubique, quod ad omnibus. What is always, what is everywhere, what is everybody believed, that's what law should be. That's common law. That's just white man's law. It's common sense. But Jewish law is all about giving work for lawyers. It's Jarndyce versus Jarndyce in Dickens. And you've got this big grey area where people don't know what the law is. They're terrified. And even the government doesn't know what the law is. You know, if they want to get this person in prison, they can do. If they don't want to, they cannot. So I sailed quite close to this illegal area. I
was close to it. By saying that it's British soldiers, it's time to stop trying to liberate other countries and liberate yourself.
Yes, and there are many ways of liberating your country. You can do it through legislation. You can do it through electing people.
Mm-hmm.
So the Crown Prosecution Service, the Director of Public Prosecutions, I was advised after I gave my speech by a fellow nationalist, a very long standing, a very wise man. He said, they will not prosecute you. Because your speech is just too damn good. It says too much. It reveals too much. It would cause too many. It's a can of worms. If it goes to court, it will create too much publicity, and information will be out there, and the truth will get out there, and they won't. They don't want that. They can do the blanket ban on it. They can silence it. They can give it a tiny little column in the paper. But probably because of all the publicity already, they won't take it to court. And that's what the government decided. No, the average jury will look at this. It's a speech about free speech. There's this baying Jewish mob attacking him. They can't hear what he's saying. You know, he's a decent sort of guy. He's been in the military 12 years. No criminal record. Impeccable military career. Blah, blah, blah. You know, he's wearing a shirt and tie. This sort of thing. This sort of thing influences juries. You know, he's got a nice smile. the average jury is not going to convict me. Or there's not a firm case of them convicting me. So they said no. So one of these Zionist groups called the Campaign Against Anything. Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, who are probably funded by Soros, George Soros. We don't know because it's all very secretive. The Zionist charities are allowed the exception of not having to name who they're members, directors, donors are.
Do they get a special exception to a rule?
Special exception to the rule.
Wow.
Yes. They are special.
They're
my
chosen.
Whole about this special
they get a chosen a chosen exception to the rule.
Ah, that word, chosen, yes, yes. So this group has been trying to get me for 13 months. 13 months they've been, you know, either been using every trick of the law they can. They've been using an army of Jewish lawyers to try and get me. And they managed in the end to get something called a judicial review. That's J-U-D, not J-E-W-D. Mm-hmm. Judicial review. It means they applied for it and the legal system agreed to a hearing in the High Court in London. And the hearing would discuss whether the law has not been applied correctly in my case. This was due to take place, and then suddenly the government backed down. And they said, okay, no need for that. We will look into the case again. We will look into it again. And this is what achieved the headlines on the Victoria Derbyshire show, on Radio 4 in the morning. I mean, everybody in Britain, everybody who's anybody, listens to Radio 4 News in the morning. And it was on there. Jeremy Bedford Turner, known as Jez Turner, said, free England from Jewish control. Oh, and the government has backed down and decided to look at the case again. And the CAA is a wonderful, glorious Jewish charity, defends Jewish human rights, has managed to get this case looked at again. This was unprecedented, by the way. This has not happened before. The judicial reviews are basically about expelling people from Britain, immigrants who failed in their asylum bids and they're expelled. And then a judicial review is launched by the very wealthy pro-immigration charities. The same sort of people who run the CAA. That's usually what a judicial review is. But the CAA, they specialise in private prosecutions of anyone they don't like. And you can do this in English law. You can launch a private prosecution for anything, murder, whatever. But it's only ever done by left-wing groups who've got lots of money and liberal groups with lots of money pushing the liberal Jewish agenda. Only those groups can really afford it. So we had a case in South London where a black drug dealer, Stephen Lawrence, was killed most probably by another black drug-dealing gang. But they had this bee in their bonnet. It was whites. This is shade to the Croydon Asylum Secret Act. Back in the day then, there was no close-circuit television, no DNA evidence, all this sort of stuff. So they tried to launch a private prosecution against these white guys, and then they got rid of double jeopardy. They were found innocent, and they tried to get them again on the same charge. Let's bear in mind, step back for a bit here. We've got English law, we've got British law, it's European law, it's white law, it's common sense, you know. The Jews come along and they alter it. They get rid of the right to remain silent when arrested. They get rid of trial by jury in certain cases. They get rid of double jeopardy. They get rid of the need for evidence. They can bring in things like racially aggravated, fighting, attacking, whatever, which means you can get double a sentence if you're in a fight with a black man because he was black. Mm-hmm. You bring in a system where if you feel you were offended, then you were offended. It's a crime, whatever the person did. You bring in speech crimes. You make things criminal that aren't really criminal at all. You get into a completely psychological madhouse. So judicial review, High Court, didn't go ahead. Government backed down. And this was, wow, what's happened here? And there's a lady, a very brave and wise lady called Monica Schaefer, who wrote an article about it. And she summed it up very well. My speech was about how the Jews are using their power to silence free speech. My speech was entitled Free Speech, and the Jews have used their power to pursue me, to persecute me, and to get a judicial review, and to get the government even to back down on that. So my speech was proved by their actions. The situation now is that the government admits I have not committed a crime under British law, but they are looking at European Union law. This is the massive laws that are pushed out of Brussels and Strasbourg. An absolute quagmire, an absolute swamp, complex laws. A lawyer's dream, it's his perfect dream. So they're looking into that. Now, let's remember, this is London, this is Britain. We've just had Brexit started. What do you think the average jury will think about a British legal system applying a European Union law against me when we've had Brexit? Yes, we've adopted European law. So it's now sort of technically British law. And those we haven't adopted, we're thinking of adopting. But the average Joe is going to say, well, hang on, we're out of Europe. No, we're out of there. So it's a very flimsy, tenuous case. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the more moderate Jews, the more careful Jews, are a bit worried about it because it might backfire on them. Now, as you are aware, the human mind has many levels to it. We've got the conscious, the subconscious, and then we've got the sub-subconscious. And I think somewhere on that day in Whitehall, with all those Zionists screaming at me, yelling at me, spitting at me, throwing things at me, somewhere in my mind I said, look, this is a chance to make a mark. This is a chance to waken people up. This is a chance to set a trap for those who would silence free speech, mm-hmm. set a trap from the enemies of our race, to set a trap for the Jewish supremacists, for the Zionists. And in a sense, I set a trap. Now, a trap's all very well. You can dig a hole in the ground and a Tyrannosaurus Rex can fall into it. What happens next? Well, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. We're in the lap of the gods. But we weren't put on Earth to avoid risk.
Right.
You can't plan a danger-free...
There's risk everywhere.
Yeah, you can't plan a safe path through life. You have to feel the fear and do it anyway, so to speak. You have to take calculated risks. Not reckless risks, but calculated risks. And the speech was a calculated risk. I mean, we've no money, we've no mass media, we've no power. What can we do? We do what we can. And a lot of people say, oh, you know, there's no point of a demonstration, no point having street corner speeches to 20 people. Well, with the internet, there is. There is.
You know, oh, yeah, there is. Impact. There is. It can echo throughout the internet. It can it gets uploaded. There's social media. There's all sorts of ways that didn't exist before that these echoes can happen. Speaking of echoes, there's that famous echo meme of putting three parentheses around Jewish names. In America, we have about 2%, well, close to 2% Jewish names, and they're everywhere. Most people don't recognize them. They recognize each other, but you turn on TV, and if you've made a habit of checking everybody's name, checking everybody, you can see that the television is full of Jews, the elite in Washington is full of Jews, not necessarily the Congress people themselves, although they're way overrepresented, but the power structure in the United States is full of Jews, and Jews themselves will talk about it, talk about dominating the media publicly, talk about dominating the media, talking about their power. Even David Brooks blurting out in one of his columns that Jews have taken over the United States. Now, to quote it is anti-Semitic. But they do say it. Now, Britain, of course, doesn't have the 2% Jewish population. It's much smaller. Yet, it seems that Jewish power is very substantial in Britain. How does it compare with Jewish power in America?
I would say it's more powerful in America. More powerful because they've had it longer. They were kicked out of the country in a very civilized way, actually, by Edward I, 1292. And they began to come back in under Cromwell. This is why they funded Oliver Cromwell. He got rid of the king. He was losing the war. You know, first of all, it's the English Civil War. He was losing. And then the Jews began to fund him and set up the New Model Army, which was new. It was the army par excellence. It was on the modern style. And with this army, funded by Jews and armed by Jews, he began to win. And he won. And when he won, he began to let the Jews come in. Even then, hundreds of years after Edward I expelled them, the British people did not want them here. He had to be very careful and let them in slyly. But they began to build their power up, and when we got rid of Cromwell, the king came back. This is Charles II. He died, and then the next king was James II. And the Jews weren't happy with the extent of their power. They wanted more power. You have this situation where James is on the throne. Then you have the Great Fire of London, the Great Plague of London. And he's beginning to sort of, under certain pressure. Now, the Jews had been expelled from Spain and everywhere else. They'd gone to Amsterdam, to Holland, because the Dutch were enamored of the Old Testament, and they regarded the Jews as being wonderful people. So they had this power base in Amsterdam. Now, William of Orange, from Holland, landed on the south coast to unseat James II, the rightful King of Britain. He had a small army. He looked as if he was going to lose. The commander of the British army marched down to meet him.
And we're talking about the 1600s.
Yep, that's it. This is called the Glorious Revolution.
So now, 1670s it's, or so?
Yeah, 1680s. And
1680s.
It's basically called the Glorious because there was no violence. but you could argue why it's called glorious, really. And then the commander of the British forces did a vault face. He switched sides. He switched sides and backed the usurper, William of Orange. And James II fled Britain and fled to the continent, and we have the Jacobites then. The Jacobites, the rightful kings of Britain, shall we say, are in exile, and William of Orange comes to the throne. He's the Jewish pet. And the commander of the British forces, in return for his treachery or his changing of sides, gets a lifetime pension from Solomon Mendoza, chief Jew of Amsterdam. And what was this commander's name? Churchill.
Wow.
The Churchills have always been traitors. From this point onwards, you get increasing Jewish power. You get the Bank of England plunging Britain into debt. You get
and British... when did the Bank of England commence?
Oh.
Just asking. I don't...
Oh, good question.
And
good
it,
question.
It's a private institution.
Yeah, yeah. You have the British Empire, you have the East India Company. It's all basically the Rothschild Empire from this point onwards. Mm-hmm. For a while, the Jews back Napoleon because he's doing their work for them, doing the same thing, getting rid of kings and liberating the Jews. The first thing Napoleon does, gets to a new little kingdom, is get rid of the king and liberate the Jews. That's the first thing he does. So they backed him, and he got a bit uppity, wouldn't do what he was told, so they got rid of him. And then they Battle of Waterloo, 1815, they backed the British, and the British were their main vehicle until the Americans became their main vehicle. But now they have the British and the Americans, and everybody knows that of all the governments controlled by, you know, let's face it, Britain and America, the Jews have more control over Britain and America than they do Israel. Yeah. It's like that, you know. So, yes, it's very strong in Britain. On the Victoria Derbyshire show where they covered my speech, got to hand it to them. They covered a bit of my speech there. They let me speak for a while on this, the video footage of my speech. And Victoria Derbyshire's face when I said free England from Jewish control was like, oh, she went scatty-eyed, you know. But the people they interviewed, they had a panel of three people there, and all of them were Jews. You know, discussing my speech. So that tells you how much control they have.
Wow.
Anything worth owning and controlling, they own and control. Everybody knows this, but nobody dare say so.
You just said the Jews have more control over the U.S. and the U.K. than they do Israel, and this wouldn't be the time to go into it, but that would be a great theme for another program.
It would. I've got a transcript of what I apparently said here. And the last paragraph is quite interesting because I'll read it out to you. This is the last bit of my speech, and it says this. Today is the 4th of July, Independence Day, when one nation fought and freed itself from international high finance. But they were wrong. They failed. We will not fail. Freedom, my friends. Let's free this land from the bankers. Let's free this land from the social engineers. Let's free this land from the politically correct thought police. Free our people from rotting on the dole. Let's free England. Let's free England from Jewish control. Let's liberate this land. Don't worry about Iraq or Syria. Don't worry about countries beyond the seas. Listen, soldiers. Listen to me. It's time we liberated our own country.
That's poetic and powerful.
I would say that is worth going to prison for.
Well, hopefully you won't have to.
Hopefully I'll be on the show again and tell you all about my further adventures.
Well, I would love to have you come back again. Thank you very much for coming on the show this morning. I will ask you to come back on again and talk about further adventures, and maybe even we might want to talk about how it is that the Jews have more control over the U.S. and the U.K. than even Israel. Thank you for coming on the show, and stay tuned for another exciting episode coming your way soon.